Oasis Audio presents The Shack by William P. Young. Read for you by Roger Mueller. Forward. Who wouldn't be skeptical when a man claims to have spent an entire weekend with God? In a shack, no less. And this was the shack. I've known Mac for a bit more than 20 years, since the day we both showed up at a neighbor's house to help him bale a field of hay to put up for his couple of cows. Since then, he and I have been, as the kids say these days, hanging out, sharing a coffee, or for me, a chai tea, extra hot with soy. Our conversations bring a deep sort of pleasure, always sprinkled with lots of laughs and, once in a while, a tear or two. Frankly, the older we get, the more we hang out, if you know what I mean. His full name is Mackenzie Allen Phillips, although most people call him Allen. It's a family tradition. The men all have the same first name, but are commonly known by their middle names, presumably to avoid the ostentation of first, second, and third, or a junior and senior. It works well for identifying telemarketers, too, especially the ones who call as if they were your best friend. So he and his grandfather, father, and now his oldest son all have the same given name of Mackenzie, but are commonly referred to by their middle names. Only Nan, his wife, and close friends call him Mac, although I have heard a few total strangers yell, "Hey, Mac, where'd you learn to drive?" Mac was born somewhere in the Midwest, farm boy in an Irish-American family committed to calloused hands and rigorous rules. Although externally religious, his overly strict church elder father was a closet drinker, especially when the rain didn't come, or came too early, and most of the times in between. Mac never talks much about him, but when he does, his face loses emotion like a tide going out, leaving dark and lifeless eyes. From the few stories Mac has told me, I know his daddy was not a fall-asleep, happy kind of alcoholic, but a vicious, mean, beat-your-wife-and-then-ask-God-for-forgiveness drunk. It all came to a head when 13-year-old Mackenzie reluctantly bared his soul to a church leader during a youth revival. Overtaken by the conviction of the moment, Mac confessed in tears that he hadn't done anything to help his mama as he witnessed, on more than one occasion, his drunken dad beat her unconscious. What Mac failed to consider was that his confessor worked and churched with his father, and by the time he got home, his daddy was waiting for him on the front porch with his mama and sisters conspicuously absent. He later learned that they'd been shuttled off to his Aunt May's in order to give his father some freedom to teach his rebellious son a lesson about respect. For almost 2 days, tied to the big oak at the back of the house, he was beaten with a belt and Bible verses every time his dad woke from a stupor and put down his bottle. 2 weeks later, when Mac was finally able to put one foot in front of the other again, he just up and walked away from home. But before he left, he put varmint poison in every bottle of booze he could find on the farm. He then unearthed from next to the outhouse the small tin box housing all his earthly treasures. One photograph of the family with everybody squinting as they looked into the sun, his daddy standing off to one side, a 1950 Luke Easter rookie baseball card, a little bottle that contained about an ounce of McGriff, the only perfume his mama had ever worn, a spool of thread and a couple needles, a small silver die-cast U.S. Air Force F-86 jet, and his entire life savings, $15.13. He crept back into the house and slipped a note under his mama's pillow while his father lay snoring off another binge. It just said, "Someday, I hope you can forgive me." He swore he would never look back, and he didn't. Not for a long time. 13 is too young to be all grown up, but Mac had a little choice and adapted quickly. He doesn't talk much about the years that followed. Most of it was spent overseas, working his way around the world, sending money to his grandparents, who passed it on to his mama. In one of those distant countries, I think he even picked up a gun in some kind of terrible conflict. He's hated war with a dark passion ever since I've known him. Whatever happened, in his early 20s, he eventually ended up in a seminary in Australia. When Mac had his fill of theology and philosophy, he came back to the States, made peace with his mama and sisters, and moved out to Oregon, where he met and married Nanette A. Samuelson. In a world of talkers, Mac is a thinker and doer. He doesn't say much unless you ask him directly, which most folks have learned not to do. When he does speak, you wonder if he isn't some sort of alien who sees the landscape of human ideas and experiences differently than everybody else. The thing is, he usually makes uncomfortable sense in a world where most folks would rather just hear what they're used to hearing, which is often not much of anything. Those who know him generally like him well enough, providing he keeps his thoughts mostly to himself. And when he does talk, it isn't that they stop liking him. Rather, they're not quite so satisfied with themselves. Mac once told me that he used to speak his mind more freely in his younger years, but he admitted that most of such talk was a survival mechanism to cover his hurts. He often ended up spewing his pain on everyone around him. He says that he had a way of pointing out people's faults and humiliating them while maintaining his own sense of false power and control. Not too endearing. As I pen these words, I reflect on the Mac I've always known. Quite ordinary, and certainly not anyone particularly special, except to those who truly know him. He is just about to turn 56, and he is a rather unremarkable, slightly overweight, balding, short white guy, which describes a lot of men in these parts. You probably wouldn't notice him in a crowd or feel uncomfortable sitting next to him while he snoozes on the max during his once-a-week trip into town for a sales meeting. He does most of his work from a little home office at his place up on Wildcat Road. He sells something high-tech and gadgety that I don't pretend to understand. Techno-gizmos that somehow make everything go faster, as if life weren't going fast enough already. You don't realize how smart Mac is unless you happen to eavesdrop on a dialogue he might be having with an expert. I've been there, when suddenly the language being spoken hardly resembles English. I find myself struggling to grasp a concept spilling out like a tumbling river of gemstones. He can speak intelligently about most anything. And even though you sense he has strong convictions, he has a gentle way about him that lets you keep yours. His favorite topics are all about God and creation and why people believe what they do. His eyes light up, and he gets this smile that curls at the corners of his lips, and suddenly, like a little kid, the tiredness melts away, and he becomes ageless and hardly able to contain himself. But at the same time, Mac is not very religious. He seems to have a love-hate relationship with religion, and maybe even with the God that he suspects is brooding, distant, and aloof. Little barbs of sarcasm occasionally spill through the cracks in his reserve, like piercing darts dipped in poison from a well deep inside. Although we sometimes both show up on Sundays at the same local pew and pulpit Bible church, the 55th Independent Assembly of St. John the Baptist, we like to call it, you can tell that he is not too comfortable there. Mac has been married to Nan for just more than 33 mostly happy years. He says she saved his life and paid a high price to do it. For some reason, beyond understanding, she seems to love him now more than ever, even though I get the sense that he hurt her something fierce in the early years. I suppose that since most of our hurts come through relationships, so will our healing. And I know that grace rarely makes sense for those looking in from the outside. In any case, Mac married up. Nan is the mortar that holds the tiles of their family together. While Mac has struggled in a world with many shades of gray, hers is mostly black and white. Common sense comes so naturally to Nan that she can't even see it for the gift it is. Raising a family kept her from pursuing dreams of becoming a doctor, but as a nurse, she has excelled and gained considerable recognition for her chosen work with oncology patients who are terminal. While Mac's relationship with God is wide, Nan's is deep. This oddly matched pair are the parents of 5 unusually beautiful kids. Mac likes to say they all got their good looks from him, because Nan still has hers. 2 of the 3 boys are out of the house. John, newly married, works in sales for a local company, and Tyler, a recent college grad, is off at school working on a master's degree. Josh and 1 of the 2 girls, Catherine, Kate, are still at home and attend the local community college. Then there is the late arrival, Melissa, or Missy, as we were fond of calling her. She, well, you'll get to know some of them better in these pages. The last few years have been, how might I put this, remarkably peculiar. Mac has changed. He's now even more different and special than he used to be. In all the time I've known him, he's been a rather gentle and kind soul. But since his stay in the hospital 3 years ago, he's been, well, even nicer. He's become one of those rare people who are totally at home in their own skin. And I feel at home around him like I do with nobody else. When we go our separate ways, it seems that I've just had the best conversation of my life, even if I usually did most of the talking. And with respect to God, Mac is no longer just wide. He has gone way deep. But the dive cost him dearly. These days are very different than 7 or so years ago, when the great sadness entered his life and he almost quit talking altogether. About that time, and for almost 2 years, our hanging out stopped, as if by some unspoken mutual agreement. I only saw Mac occasionally at the local grocery store, or even more rarely at church, and although a polite hug was usually exchanged, not much of any consequence was spoken. It was even difficult for him to look me in the eyes. Maybe he didn't want to enter a conversation that might tear the scab off his wounded heart. But that all changed after a nasty accident with... But there I go again, getting ahead of myself. We'll get to all that in due time. Just to say that these last few years seem to have given Mac his life back and lifted the burden of the great sadness. What happened 3 years ago totally changed the melody of his life, and it's a song I can't wait to play for you. Although he communicates well enough verbally, Mac is not comfortable with his writing skills, something that he knows I am passionate about. So he asked if I would ghostwrite this story, his story, for the kids and for Nan. He wanted a narrative to help him express to them not only the depth of his love, but also to help them understand what has been going on in his inside world. You know that place where there is just you alone, and maybe God, if you believe in him. Of course, God might be there even if you don't believe in him. That would be just like him. He hasn't been called the grand interferer for nothing. What you are about to read is something that Mac and I have struggled with for many months to put into words. It's a little... Well, no, it is a lot on the fantastic side. Whether some parts of it are actually true or not, I won't be the judge. Suffice it to say that while some things may not be scientifically provable, they can still be true nonetheless. I will tell you honestly that being a part of this story has affected me deep inside, in places I had never been before and didn't even know existed. I confess to you that I desperately want everything Mac has told me to be true. Most days I'm right there with him, but on others, when the visible world of concrete and computers seem to be the real world, I lose touch and have my doubts. A couple of final disclaimers. Mac would like you to know that if you happen upon this story and hate it, he says, sorry, but it wasn't primarily written for you. Then again, maybe it was. What you are about to read is the best Mac can remember about what happened. This is his story, not mine, so the few times I show up, I'll refer to myself in the third person, from Mac's point of view. Memory can be a tricky companion at times, especially with the accident, and I would not be too surprised, in spite of our concerted effort toward accuracy, if some factual errors and faulty remembrances are reflected in these pages. They are not intentional. I can promise you that the conversations and events are recorded as truthfully as Mac can remember them. So please, try and cut him a little slack. As you'll see, these are not easy things to talk about. A confluence of paths. Two roads diverged in the middle of my life. I heard a wise man say, I took the road less traveled by, and that's made the difference every night and every day. Larry Norman, with apologies to Robert Frost. March unleashed a torrent of rainfall after an abnormally dry winter. A cold front out of Canada then descended and was held in place by a swirling wind that roared down the gorge from eastern Oregon. Although spring was surely just around the corner, the god of winter was not about to relinquish its hard-won dominion without a tussle. There was a blanket of new snow in the Cascades, and rain was now freezing on impact with the frigid ground outside the house, enough reason for Mac to snuggle up with a book and a hot cider and wrap up in the warmth of a crackling fire. But instead, he spent the better part of the morning telecommuting into his downtown desktop. Sitting comfortably in his home office, wearing pajama pants and a T-shirt, he made his sales calls, mostly to the East Coast. He paused frequently, listening to the sound of crystalline rain tinging off his window and watching the slow but steady accumulation of frozen ice thickening on everything outside. He was becoming inexorably trapped as an ice prisoner in his own home, much to his delight. There is something joyful about storms that interrupt routine. Snow or freezing rain suddenly releases you from expectations, performance demands, and the tyranny of appointments and schedules. And unlike illness, it is largely a corporate rather than individual experience. One can almost hear a unified sigh rise from the nearby city and surrounding countryside, where nature has intervened to give respite to the weary humans slogging it out within her purview. All those affected this way are united by a mutual excuse, and the heart is suddenly and unexpectedly a little giddy. There will be no apologies needed for not showing up to some commitment or other. Everyone understands and shares in this singular justification, and the sudden alleviation of the pressure to produce makes the heart merry. Of course, it is also true that storms interrupt business, and while a few companies make a bit extra, some companies lose money, meaning there are those who find no joy when everything shuts down temporarily. But they can't blame anyone for their loss of production or for not being able to make it to the office. Even if it's hardly more than a day or two, somehow each person feels like the master of his or her own world, simply because those little droplets of water freeze as they hit the ground. Even commonplace activities become extraordinary. Routine choices become adventures and are often experienced with a sense of heightened clarity. Late in the afternoon, Mac bundled up and headed outdoors to struggle the 100 yards or so down the long driveway to the mailbox. The ice had magically turned this simple, everyday task into a foray against the elements, the raising of his fist in opposition to the brute power of nature and, in an act of defiance, laughing in its face. The fact that no one would notice or care mattered little to him. Just the thought made him smile inside. The icy rain pellets stung his cheeks and hands as he carefully worked his way up and down the slight undulations of the driveway. He looked, he supposed, like a drunken sailor gingerly heading toward the next watering hole. When you face the force of an ice storm, you don't exactly walk boldly forward in a show of unbridled confidence. Bluster will get you battered. Mac had to get up off his knees twice before he was finally hugging the mailbox like some long-lost friend. He paused to take in the beauty of a world engulfed in crystal. Everything reflected light and contributed to the heightened brilliance of the late afternoon. The trees in the neighbor's field had all donned translucent mantles, and each now stood unique but unified in their presentation. It was a glorious world, and for a brief moment its blazing splendor almost lifted, even if only for a few seconds, the great sadness from Mac's shoulders. It took almost a minute to knock off the ice that had already sealed shut the door of the mailbox. The reward for his efforts was a single envelope with only his first name typewritten on the outside. No stamp, no postmark, and no return address. Curious, he tore the end off the envelope, which was no easy task with fingers beginning to stiffen from the cold. Turning his back to the breath-snatching wind, he finally coaxed the single small rectangle of unfolded paper out of its nest. The typewritten message simply said, "Mackenzie, it's been a while. I've missed you. I'll be at the shack next weekend if you want to get together. Papa." Max stiffened as a wave of nausea rolled over him, and then, just as quickly, mutated into anger. He purposely thought about the shack as little as possible, and even when he did, his thoughts were neither kind nor good. If this was someone's idea of a bad joke, they had truly outdone themselves, and to sign it Papa just made it all the more horrifying. Idiot. He was thinking about Tony the mailman. An overly friendly Italian with a big heart but little tact. Why would he even deliver such a ridiculous envelope? It wasn't even stamped. Mac angrily stuffed the envelope and note into his coat pocket and turned to start the slide back in the general direction of the house. Buffeting gusts of wind, which had initially slowed him, now shortened the time it took to traverse the mini-glacier that was thickening beneath his feet. He was doing just fine, thank you, until he reached that place in the driveway that sloped a little downward and to the left. Without any effort or intention, he began to build up speed, sliding on shoes with soles that had about as much traction as a duck landing on a frozen pond, arms flailing wildly in hopes of somehow maintaining the potential for balance. Mac found himself careening directly toward the only tree of any substantial size bordering the driveway, the one whose lower limbs he had hacked off only a few short months before. Now it stood eager to embrace him, half naked and seemingly anxious for a little retribution. In a fraction of a thought, he chose the chicken's way out and tried to plop himself down by allowing his feet to slip out from under him, which is what they had naturally wanted to do anyway. Better to have a sore butt than pick slivers out of his face. But the adrenaline rush caused him to overcompensate, and in slow motion, Mac watched his feet rise up in front of him as if jerked up by some jungle trap. He hit hard, back of the head first, and skidded to a heap at the base of the shimmering tree, which seemed to stand over him with a smug look, mixed with disgust and not a little disappointment. The world went momentarily black, or so it seemed. He lay there dazed and staring up into the sky, squinting as the icy precipitation rapidly cooled his flushed face. For a fleeting pause, everything felt oddly warm and peaceful, his ire momentarily knocked out by the impact. Now who's the idiot? He hoped that no one had been watching. Cold was creeping quickly through his coat and sweater, and Mac knew the ice rain that was both melting and freezing beneath him would soon become a major discomfort. Groaning and feeling like a much older man, he rolled onto his hands and knees. It was then that he saw the bright red skid mark tracing his journey from the point of impact to final destination. As if birthed by the sudden awareness of his injury, a dull pounding began crawling up the back of his head. Instinctively, he reached for the source of the drumbeat and brought his hand away bloody. With rough ice and sharp gravel gouging his hands and knees, Mac half crawled and half slid until he eventually made it to a level part of the driveway. With not a little effort, he was finally able to stand and gingerly inch his way toward the house, humbled by the powers of ice and gravity. Once inside, Mac methodically shed the layers of outerwear as best he could, his half-frozen fingers responding with about as much dexterity as oversized clubs at the ends of his arms. He decided to leave the drizzly, blood-stained mess right where he doffed it in the entryway, and retreated painfully to the bathroom to examine his wounds. There was no question that the icy driveway had won. The gash on the back of his head was oozing around a few small pebbles still embedded in his scalp. As he had feared, a significant lump had already formed. emerging like a humpbacked whale breaching the wild waves of his thinning hair. Mac found it a difficult chore to patch himself up by trying to see the back of his head using a small handheld mirror that reflected a reverse image off the bathroom mirror. A short frustration later, he gave up, unable to get his hands to go in the right directions, and unsure which of the two mirrors was lying to him. By gingerly probing around the soggy gash, he succeeded in picking out the biggest pieces of debris until it hurt too much to continue. Grabbing some first aid ointment and plugging the wound as best he could, he then tied a washcloth to the back of his head with some gauze he found in a bathroom drawer. Glancing at himself in the mirror, he thought he looked a little like some rough sailor out of Moby Dick. It made him laugh, and then wince. He would have to wait until Nan made it home before he could get any real medical attention, one of the many benefits of being married to a registered nurse. Anyway, he knew that the worse it looked, the more sympathy he would get. There is often some compensation in every trial if one looked hard enough. He swallowed a couple over-the-counter painkillers to dull the throbbing and limped toward the front entry. Not for an instant had Mac forgotten about the note. Rummaging through the pile of wet and bloody clothing, he finally found it in his coat pocket, glanced at it, and then headed back into his office. He located the post office number and dialed it. As expected, Annie, the matronly postmaster and keeper of everyone's secrets, answered the phone. "Hi, is Tony in by chance?"
"Hey, Mac, is that you? I recognized your voice."
"Of course she did."
"Sorry, but Tony ain't back yet. In fact, I just talked to him on the radio, and he's only made it halfway up Wildcat. Not even to your place yet. Do you need me to have him call you, or would you just like to leave a message?"
"Oh, hi. Is that you, Annie?" He couldn't resist, even though her Midwestern accent left no doubt.
"Sorry, I was busy for a second there. Didn't hear a word you said."
"Now, Mac, I know you heard every word. Don't you be going and trying to kid a kidder. I wasn't born yesterday, you know. What do you want me to tell him if he makes it back alive?"
"Actually, you already answered my question."
There was a pause at the other end.
"Actually, I don't remember you asking a question. What's wrong with you, Mac? Still smoking too much dope, or do you just do that on Sunday mornings to make it through the church service?"
At this, she started to laugh, as if caught off guard by the brilliance of her own sense of humor.
"Now, Annie, you know I don't smoke dope. Never did, and don't ever want to."
Of course, Annie knew no such thing. But Mac was taking no chances on how she might remember the conversation in a day or two. Wouldn't be the first time that her sense of humor morphed into a good story that soon became fact. He could see his name being added to the church prayer chain.
"It's okay. I'll just catch Tony some other time. No big deal."
"Okay, then. Just stay indoors where it's safe. Don't you know an old guy like you could have lost his sense of balance over the years? Wouldn't want to see you slip and hurt your pride. The way things are shaping up, Tony may not make it up to your place at all. We can do snow, sleet, and darkness of night pretty well, but this frozen rain stuff, it's a challenge to be sure."
"Thanks, Annie. I'll try and remember your advice. Talk to you later. Bye now."
His head was pounding more than ever, little trip hammers beating to the rhythm of his heart.
That's odd. Who would dare put something like that in our mailbox?
The painkillers had not yet fully kicked in, but were present enough to dull the edge of worry that he was starting to feel, and he was suddenly very tired. Laying his head down on the desk, he thought he had just dropped off to sleep when the phone startled him awake.
Hello?
"Hi, love. Well, you sound like you've been asleep."
It was Nan, sounding unusually cheery, even though he felt he could hear the underlying sadness that lurked just beneath the surface of every conversation. She loved this kind of weather as much as he usually did. He switched on the desk lamp and glanced at the clock, surprised that he had been out for a couple hours.
Sorry, I guess I dozed off for a bit."
"Well, you sound a little groggy. Is everything all right?"
"Yeah."
Even though it was almost dark outside, Mac could see that the storm had not let up. It had even deposited a couple more inches of ice. Tree branches were hanging low, and he knew some would eventually break from the weight, especially if the wind kicked up.
I had a little tussle with the driveway when I got the mail, but other than that, everything is fine. Where are you?
I'm still at Arlene's, and I think me and the kids will spend the night here. It's always good for Kate to be around the family. Seems to restore a little balance.
Arlene was Nan's sister who lived across the river in Washington.
Anyway, it's really too slick to go out. Hopefully it'll break up by morning. I wish I'd made it home before it got so bad, but oh well. How's it up at the house?
Well, it's absolutely stunningly beautiful, and a whole lot safer to look at than walk in, trust me. I for sure don't want you to try and get up here in this mess. Nothing's moving. I don't even think Tony was able to bring us the mail.
I thought you already got the mail.
Nope, I didn't actually get the mail. I thought Tony had already come, and I went out to get it. There...
He hesitated, looking down at the note that lay on the desk where he had placed it.
Wasn't any mail yet. I called Annie, and she said Tony probably wouldn't be able to make it up the hill, and I'm not going to go out there again to see if he did. Anyway, how is Kate doing over there?
There was a pause, and then a long sigh. When Nan spoke, her voice was hushed to a whisper, and he could tell she was covering her mouth on the other end.
Mac, I wish I knew. She's just like talking to a rock, and no matter what I do, I can't get through. When we're around family, she seems to come out of her shell some, but then she disappears again. I just don't know what to do. I've been praying and praying that Papa would help us find a way to reach her, but it feels like he isn't listening.
There it was. Papa was Nan's favorite name for God, and it expressed her delight in the intimate friendship she had with him.
Honey, I'm sure God knows what he's doing. It will all work out.
The words brought him no comfort, but he hoped they might ease the worry he could hear in her voice.
I know. I just wish he'd hurry up.
Me too.
It was all Mac could think to say.
Well, you and the kids stay put and stay safe. And tell Arlene and Jimmy hi, and thank them for me. Hopefully I'll see you tomorrow.
Okay, love. I should go and help the others. Everyone's busy looking for candles in case the power goes out. You should probably do the same. There's some above the sink in the basement, and there's leftover stuffed bread dough in the fridge that you can heat up. Are you sure you're okay?
Yeah, my pride is hurt more than anything.
Well, take it easy, and hopefully we'll see you in the morning.
All right, honey. Be safe, and call me if you need anything.
Bye.
It was kind of a dumb thing to say, he thought as he hung up the phone. Kind of a manly, dumb thing, as if he could help if they needed anything. Max sat and stared at the note. It was confusing and painful, trying to sort out the swirling cacophony of disturbing emotions and dark images clouding his mind. A million thoughts, traveling a million miles an hour. Finally, he gave up, folded the note, slid it into a small tin box he kept on the desk, and switched off the light. Mac managed to find something to heat up in the microwave. Then he grabbed a couple of blankets and pillows and headed for the living room. A quick glance at the clock told him that Bill Moyer's show had just started, a favorite program that he tried never to miss. Moyer was one of a handful of people who Mac would love to meet. A brilliant and outspoken man, able to express intense compassion for both people and truth with unusual clarity. One of the stories tonight had something to do with oil man Boone Pickens, who was now starting to drill for water, of all things. Almost without thinking, and without taking his eyes off the television, Mac reached over to the end table, picked up a photo frame holding a picture of a little girl, and clutched it to his chest. With the other, he pulled the blankets up under his chin and hunkered deeper into the sofa. Soon the sounds of gentle snoring filled the air as the media tube turned its attention to a piece on a high school senior in Zimbabwe who had been beaten for speaking out against his government. But Mac had already left the room to wrestle with his dreams. Maybe tonight there would be no nightmares, only visions, perhaps, of ice and trees and gravity. The Gathering Dark. Nothing makes us so lonely as our secrets. Paul Tournier. Sometime during the night, an unexpected Chinook blew through the Willamette Valley, freeing the landscape from the storm's icy grip, except for those things that lay hidden in the deepest shadows. Within 24 hours, it was early summer warm. Max slept late into the morning, one of those dreamless sleeps that seems to pass in an instant. When he finally crawled off the sofa, he was somewhat chagrined to see that the ice follies had fizzled out so quickly, but delighted to see Nan and the kids when they showed up less than an hour later. First came the anticipated and considerable scolding for not putting his bloodied mess in the laundry room, followed by an appropriate and satisfying amount of oohing and aahing that accompanied her examination of his head wound. The attention pleased Mac immensely, and Nan soon had him cleaned up, patched up, and fed up. The note, though never far from his mind, was not mentioned. He still didn't know what to think of it, and he didn't want Nan included if it turned out to be some kind of cruel joke. Little distractions, like the ice storm, were a welcome, although brief respite from the haunting presence of his constant companion, the great sadness, as he referred to it. Shortly after the summer that Missy vanished, the great sadness had draped itself around Mac's shoulders like some invisible but almost tangibly heavy quilt. The weight of its presence dulled his eyes and stooped his shoulders. Even his efforts to shake it off were exhausting, as if his arms were sewn into its bleak folds of despair, and he had somehow become a part of it. He ate, worked, loved, dreamed, and played in this garment of heaviness, weighed down as if he were wearing a leaden bathrobe, trudging daily through the murky despondency that sucked the color out of everything. At times, he could feel the great sadness slowly tightening around his chest and heart, like the crushing coils of a constrictor, squeezing liquid from his eyes until he thought there no longer remained a reservoir. Other times, he would dream that his feet were stuck in cloying mud, as he caught brief glimpses of Missy running down the wooded path ahead of him, her red cotton summer dress gilded with wildflowers flashing among the trees. She was completely oblivious to the dark shadow tracking her from behind. Although he frantically tried to scream warnings to her, no sound emerged, and he was always too late and too impotent to save her. He would bolt upright in bed, sweat dripping from his tortured body, while waves of nausea and guilt and regret rolled over him like some surreal tidal flood. The story of Missy's disappearance is unfortunately not unlike others told too often. It all happened during Labor Day weekend, the summer's last hurrah before another year of school and autumn routines. Mac boldly decided to take the three younger children on a final camping trip to Wallawa Lake in northeastern Oregon. Nan was already booked at a continuing education class in Seattle, and the two older boys were back at college or counseling at a summer camp. But Mac was confident that he possessed the right combination of outdoorsmanship and mothering skills. After all, Nan had taught him well. The sense of adventure and camping fever gripped everyone, and the place became a whirlwind of activity. If they had done it Mac's way, they would have simply backed a moving van up to the house and shifted most of its contents for the long weekend. At one point in all the confusion, Mac decided he needed a break and settled himself in his daddy chair after shooing off Judas, the family cat. He was about to turn on the tube when Missy came running in, holding her little plexiglass box. "Can I take my insect collection camping with us?" "You want to take your bugs along?" "Daddy, they're not bugs. They're insects. Look, I've got lots of them in here." Mac reluctantly turned his attention to his daughter, who, seeing him focus, started explaining the contents of her treasure box. "See, there are two grasshoppers, and see on that leaf, there is my caterpillar, and somewhere, there she is. Do you see my ladybug? And I have a fly in here somewhere, too, and some ants." As she inventoried her collection, Mac tried his best to show attention, nodding along. "So, can I take them along?" "Sure you can, honey. Maybe we can let them loose in the wild while we're out there." "No, she can't. Missy, you need to keep your collection at home, honey. Trust me, they're safer here." Nan stuck her head around the corner from the kitchen and lovingly frowned at Mac as he shrugged his shoulders. "I tried, honey." Missy growled, but knowing the battle was lost, she picked up her box and left. By Thursday night, the van was overloaded, and the pull-behind tent trailer hitched up with lights and brakes tested. Early Friday, after one last lecture from Nan to her kids about safety, obedience, brushing teeth in the mornings, not picking up cats with white stripes down their backs, and all manners of other things, they headed out. Nan, north up Interstate 205 to Washington, and Mac and the three amigos east on Interstate 84. The plan was to return the following Tuesday night, just before the first day of school. The Columbia River Gorge is worth the trip by itself, with breathtaking panoramas overseen by river-carved mesas, standing sleepy guard in the late summer warmth. September and October can offer some of Oregon's best weather. Indian summer often sets in around Labor Day and hangs on until Halloween, when it quickly turns cold, wet, and nasty. This year was no exception. Traffic and weather cooperated wonderfully, and the crew hardly noticed the time and miles passing by. The foursome stopped at Multnomah Falls to buy a coloring book and crayons for Missy and two inexpensive, waterproof disposable cameras for Kate and Josh. They then decided to climb the short distance up the trail to the bridge facing the falls. There had once been a path which led around the main pool and into a shallow cave behind the tumbling water, but unfortunately, it had been blocked off by the park authorities because of erosion. Missy loved it here, and she begged her daddy to tell the legend of the beautiful Indian maid, the daughter of a chief of the Multnomah tribe. It took some coaxing, but Mac finally relented and retold the story as they all stared up into the mists shrouding the falling cascade. The tale centered on a princess, the only child left to her aging father. The chief loved his daughter dearly, and carefully picked out a husband for her, a young warrior chief of the Clatsop tribe, whom he knew she loved. The two tribes came together to celebrate the days of the wedding feast, but before it could begin, a terrible sickness began to spread among the men, killing many. The elders and the chiefs met to discuss what they could do about the wasting disease that was quickly decimating their warriors. The oldest medicine man among them spoke of how his own father, when aged and near death, had foretold of a terrible sickness that would kill their men, an illness that could only be stopped if a pure and innocent daughter of a chief would willingly give up her life for her people. In order to fulfill the prophecy, she must voluntarily climb to a cliff above the big river and from there jump to her death onto the rocks below. A dozen young women, all daughters of the various chiefs, were brought before the council. After considerable debate, the elders decided that they could not ask for such a precious sacrifice, especially for a legend they weren't sure was true. But the disease continued to spread unabated among the men, and eventually the young warrior chief, the husband-to-be, fell ill with the sickness. The princess, who loved him, knew in her heart that something had to be done, and after cooling his fever and kissing him softly on the forehead, she slipped away. It took her all night and the next day to reach the place spoken of in the legend, a towering cliff overlooking the big river and the lands beyond. After praying and giving herself to the Great Spirit, she fulfilled the prophecy by jumping without hesitation to her death on the rocks below. Back at the villages the next morning, those who had been sick arose well and strong. There was great joy and celebration until the young warrior discovered that his beloved bride was missing. As the awareness of what had happened spread rapidly among the people, many began the journey to the place where they knew they would find her. As they silently gathered around her broken body at the base of the cliff, her grief-stricken father cried out to the Great Spirit, asking that her sacrifice would always be remembered. At that moment, water began to fall from the place where she had jumped, turning into a fine mist that fell at their feet, slowly forming a beautiful pool. Missy usually loved the telling, almost as much as Mac did. It had all the elements of a true redemption story, not unlike the story of Jesus that she knew so well. It centered on a father who loved his only child and a sacrifice foretold by a prophet. Because of love, the child willingly gave up her life to save her betrothed and their tribes from certain death. But on this occasion, Missy didn't say a word when the story was finished.
Instead, she immediately turned and headed for the van as if to say, "Okay, I'm done here. Let's get going." They made a quick stop for some brunch and a potty break at Hood River and then got right back on the road, reaching La Grande by early afternoon. Here they left I-84 and took the Wallawa Lake Highway, which would take them the final 72 miles to the town of Joseph. The lake and campground they were headed for was only a few miles beyond Joseph, and after finding their site, they all pitched in and had everything set up in short order. Perhaps not exactly the way Nan would have preferred, but functional nonetheless. The first meal was a Phillips family tradition, flank steak, marinated in Uncle Joe's secret sauce. For dessert, they ate the brownies Nan had made the night before, topped with the vanilla ice cream they had packed away in dry ice. That evening, as he sat between three laughing children watching one of nature's greatest shows, Mac's heart was suddenly penetrated by unexpected joy. A sunset of brilliant colors and patterns played off the few clouds that had waited in the wings to become central actors in this unique presentation. He was a rich man, he thought to himself, in all the ways that mattered. By the time supper was cleaned up, night had fallen. The deer, routine day visitors and sometimes a serious nuisance, had gone wherever deer go to bed down. Their shift was picked up by the night troublemakers, raccoons, squirrels, and chipmunks that traveled in roving bands looking for any container left slightly open. The Phillips campers knew this from past experience. The first night they had ever spent in these campgrounds had cost them 4 dozen Rice Krispies treats, a box of chocolates, and all their peanut butter cookies. Before it got too late, the four went on a short hike away from the campfires and lanterns to a dark and quiet spot where they could lie down and gaze in wonder at the Milky Way, stunning and intense when undiminished by the pollution of city lights. Mac could lie and gaze up into that vastness for hours. He felt so incredibly small, yet comfortable with himself. Of all the places he sensed the presence of God, out here, surrounded by nature and under the stars, was one of the most tangible. He could almost hear the song of worship they sang to their Creator, and in his reluctant heart, he joined in as best he could. Then it was back to the campsite, and after several trips to the facilities, Mac tucked the three in turn into the safety and security of their sleeping bags. He prayed briefly with Josh before moving across to where Kate and Missy lay waiting. But when it came Missy's turn to pray, she wanted to talk instead.
"Daddy, how come she had to die?"
It took Mac a moment to figure out who it was that Missy was talking about, suddenly realizing that the Multnomah Princess must have been on her mind since they'd stopped earlier.
"Honey, she didn't have to die. She chose to die to save her people. They were very sick, and she wanted them to be healed."
There was silence, and Mac knew that another question was forming in the darkness. "Did it really happen?" This time the question was from Kate, obviously interested in the conversation.
"Oh, did what really happen? Did the Indian princess really die? Is the story true?"
Mac thought before he spoke.
"I don't know, Kate. It's a legend, and sometimes legends are stories that teach a lesson." "So it didn't really happen?"
"It might have, sweetie. Sometimes legends are built from real stories, things that really happen." Again, silence. Then,
"So is Jesus dying a legend?"
Mac could hear the wheels turning in Kate's mind.
"No, honey, that's a true story. And you know what? I think the Indian princess story is probably true, too."
Mac waited while his girls processed their thoughts.
"Is the Great Spirit another name for God? You know, Jesus' papa?"
Mac smiled in the dark. Obviously, Nan's nightly prayers were having an effect.
"I would suppose so. It's a good name for God, because he is a spirit, and he is great." "And how come he's so mean?"
Ah, here was the question that had been brewing.
"What do you mean, Missy?" "Well, the Great Spirit makes the princess jump off the cliff and makes Jesus die on a cross. That seems pretty mean to me.
Mac was stuck. He wasn't sure how to answer. At 6.5 years old, Missy was asking questions that wise people had wrestled with for centuries.
"Sweetheart, Jesus didn't think his daddy was mean. He thought his daddy was full of love and loved him very much. His daddy didn't make him die. Jesus chose to die because he and his daddy love you and me and everyone in the world. He saved us from our sickness, just like the princess."
Now came the longest silence, and Mac was beginning to wonder if the girls had fallen asleep. Just as he was about to lean over and kiss them goodnight, a little voice with a noticeable quiver broke into the quiet.
"Daddy?"
"Yes, honey."
"Will I ever have to jump off a cliff?"
Mac's heart broke as he understood what this conversation had really been about. He gathered his little girl into his arms and pulled her close. With his own voice, a little huskier than usual, he gently replied,
"No, honey, I will never ask you to jump off a cliff. Never, ever, ever."
"Then will God ever ask me to jump off a cliff?"
"No, Missy, he would never ask you to do anything like that."
She snuggled deeper into his arms.
"Okay, hold me close. Good night, Daddy. I love you."
And she was out, drifting deep into a sound sleep with only good and sweet dreams. After a few minutes, Mac placed her gently back in her sleeping bag.
"Are you okay, Kate?"
He kissed her good night.
"Yep." "Daddy."
"What, sweetheart?"
"She asks good questions, doesn't she?"
"She sure does. She's a special little girl. You both are, except you're not so little anymore. Now, get some sleep. We have a big day ahead of us. Sweet dreams, darling."
"You too, Daddy. I love you tons."
"I love you too, with all my heart.
Good night."
Mac zipped up the trailer on his way out, blew his nose, and wiped away the tears that still remained on his cheek. He prayed a silent thanks to God, and then went to brew some coffee. The Tipping Point. The soul is healed by being with children. Fyodor Dostoevsky. Wallowa Lake State Park in Oregon and its surrounding area has been well referred to as the Little Switzerland of America. Wild, rugged mountains rise to almost 10,000 feet, and in between them are hidden innumerable valleys full of streams, hiking trails, and high-elevation meadows overflowing with sprays of wildflowers. Wallowa Lake is the gateway into the Eagle Cap Wilderness Area and Hell's Canyon National Recreation Area, which sports the deepest gorge in North America. Carved out over centuries by the Snake River, it reaches a couple miles top to bottom in places and 10 miles at times from rim to rim. 75% of the recreation area is roadless, with more than 900 miles of hiking trails. Once the domain of the prevailing Nez Perce tribe, the remnants of their presence are scattered throughout this wilderness, as well as those of white settlers traveling through on their way to the west. The nearby town of Joseph was named for a powerful tribal chief whose Indian name meant thunder rolling down the mountain. This area is home to an abundance of flora and wildlife, including elk, bear, deer, and mountain goat. The presence of rattlers, especially as you get closer to the Snake River, is reason enough to hike cautiously, should you decide to venture off-trail. Wallowa Lake itself is 5 miles long and 1 mile wide, formed, some say, by glaciers 9 million years ago. It now sits about a mile from the town of Joseph, at an elevation of 4,400 feet. The water, though catch-your-breath cold most of the year, is comfortable enough by the end of summer for a leisurely swim, at least close into shore. Sacagawea, at almost 10,000 feet, looks down on this blue jewel from her snow-capped and timbered heights. Mac and the kids fill the next 3 days with fun and leisure. Missy, seemingly satisfied with her daddy's answers, never again raised the issue of the princess, even when one of their day hikes took them by some precipitous cliffs. They spent a few hours traveling the lake shore on paddle boats, tried their best to win a prize at miniature golf, and even went horseback trail riding. After a morning trip to the historic Wade Ranch that sits about halfway between Joseph and Enterprise, they spent the afternoon visiting the little shops in the town of Joseph itself. Back at the lake, Josh and Kate raced each other around the go-kart track. Josh came away the winner, but Kate was able to regain bragging rights later that afternoon when she landed 3 good-sized lake trout. Missy caught one with hook and worm, but neither Josh nor Mac could claim a single tug on their fancier lures. Sometime during the weekend, 2 other families seemed to magically weave themselves into the Phillips world. As often happens, friendships had been struck up initially amongst the children and then between the adults. Josh had been especially keen on getting to know the Doucettes, whose eldest, Amber, just happened to be a cute young lady about his age. Kate seriously enjoyed tormenting her older brother about the entire matter, and he would reward her taunting by stomping off to the tent trailer all bluster and gripe. Amber had a sister, Emmy, who was only a year younger than Kate, and the two spent a lot of time together. Vicky and Emil Doucette had traveled from their home in Colorado, where Emil worked as an agent for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Office of Law Enforcement, and stayed home to manage the household, which included their surprise son, J.J., now almost a year old. The Doucettes introduced Mac and his children to a Canadian couple they had met earlier, Jesse and Sarah Madison. These two had an easy, unpretentious manner, and Mac took an instant liking to them. Both careered as independent consultants, Jesse in human resources and Sarah in change management. Missy gravitated immediately to Sarah, and both were often together down at the Doucette campsite helping Vicky with J.J. Monday broke gloriously, and the entire entourage was excited about their plans to take the Wallowa Lake Tramway to the top of Mount Howard, 8,150 feet above sea level. When it was constructed in 1970, the tramway had the steepest vertical lift in North America, with a cable length of almost 4 miles. The trip to the summit takes about 15 minutes in a tram car that dangles anywhere from 3 feet to 120 feet off the ground. Instead of packing a lunch, Jesse and Sarah insisted on treating everyone to a meal at the summit grill. The plan was to eat as soon as they reached the top and then spend the rest of the day hiking to the 5 viewpoints and overlooks. Armed with cameras, sunglasses, water bottles, and sunscreen, they headed off by mid-morning. As intended, they consumed a veritable feast of hamburgers, fries, and shakes at the grill. The elevation must have spurred their appetites. Even Missy was able to down an entire burger and most of the trimmings. After lunch, they hiked to each of the nearby lookouts, the longest trail being from the valley overlook to the Snake River country and Seven Devils Lookout, a little more than 3/4 of a mile. From the Wallowa Valley overlook, they could see as far as the towns of Joseph, Enterprise, Lostien, and even Wallowa. From the Royal Purple Overlook and the Summit Overlook, they enjoyed the crystal-clear view, looking into the states of Washington and Idaho. Some even thought they could see across the Idaho Panhandle into Montana. By late afternoon, everyone was tired and happy. Missy, whom Jesse had carried on his shoulders to the last couple of lookouts, was now falling asleep in her father's arms as they bumped and whirred down from the summit. The 4 young people, along with Sarah, had their faces plastered against the windows, oohing and eyeing at the wonders to be seen along the descent. The Doucettes sat holding hands in quiet conversation, while J.J. slept in his father's arms. "This is one of those rare and precious moments that catches you by surprise and almost takes your breath away. If only Nan could be here, it truly would be perfect." He shifted Missy's weight to a more comfortable position for her, now that she was totally out, and pulled back the hair from her face to look at her. The grime and sweat of the day had done nothing but strangely enhance her innocence and beauty. "Why do they have to grow up?" He kissed her on the forehead. That evening, the 3 families combined their food for a last supper together. Taco salad was the entree, with lots of cut fresh vegetables and dip, and somehow Sarah had been able to whip up a chocolate dessert with layers of whipped cream, mousse, brownies, and other delights that had everyone feeling decadent and satisfied. With the remains of supper stashed back in the coolers and the dishes cleaned and put away, the adults sat sipping coffee around a blazing campfire, while Emil shared his adventures of breaking up endangered animal smuggling rings and explaining how they caught poachers and others who hunted illegally. He was a skilled storyteller, and his vocation offered a deep resource for some hilarious tales. It was all fascinating, and Mac realized again that there was much in the world about which he was naive. As the evening wound down, Emil and Vicky headed for bed first with their sleepy-eyed baby. Jesse and Sarah volunteered to stay a while before walking the Doucette girls back to their campsite. The three Phillips kids and two Doucettes immediately disappeared into the safety of the tent trailer to share stories and secrets. As often happens when a campfire burns long, the conversation turned from the humorous to the more personal. Sarah seemed eager to ask Mac about the rest of his family, especially Nan. "So, what is she like, Mackenzie?" Mac loved any opportunity to brag about his Nan. "Well, besides being beautiful, and I'm not just saying that, she really is beautiful, inside and out." He looked up sheepishly to see them both smiling at him. He was really missing her, and was glad the night shadows hid his embarrassment. "Her full name is Nanette, but almost no one calls her anything but Nan. She has quite a reputation in the medical community, at least in the Northwest. She's a nurse and works with oncology patients, cancer patients who are terminal. It's tough work, but she really loves it. Anyway, she's written some papers and has been a speaker at a couple conferences."
"Really? What does she speak on?"
"She helps people think through their relationship with God in the face of their own death."
"Oh, I'd love to hear more about that," encouraged Jesse as he stirred up the fire with a stick, causing it to bloom with renewed vigor.
Mac hesitated. As much as he felt unusually at ease with these two, he didn't really know them, and the conversation had gotten a little deeper than he was comfortable with. He searched quickly for a short answer to Jesse's interest.
"Nan's a lot better at that than I am. I guess she thinks about God differently than most folks. She even calls him Papa because of the closeness of their relationship, if that makes sense."
"Of course it does."
Jesse nodded.
"Is that a family thing, referring to God as Papa?"
"No. The kids picked it up some, but I'm not comfortable with it. It just seems a little too familiar for me. Anyway, Nan has a wonderful father, so I think it's just easier for her."
It had slipped out, and Mac inwardly shuddered, hoping no one had noticed, but Jesse was looking right at him.
"Your dad wasn't too wonderful."
"Yeah. I guess you could say he was not too wonderful. He died when I was just a kid, of natural causes."
Mac laughed, but the sound was empty. He looked at the two.
"He drank himself to death."
"We're so sorry."
Sarah said it for both of them, and Mac could sense that she meant it.
"Well, life is hard sometimes, but I have a lot to be thankful for."
An awkward silence followed, as Mac wondered what it was about these two that seemed to penetrate his defenses so easily. He was rescued seconds later by a flurry of children as they poured out of the trailer and into their midst. Much to Kate's glee, she and Emmy had caught Josh and Amber holding hands in the dark, and now she wanted the whole world to know. By this time, Josh was so smitten that he was willing to put up with any harassment and took what she dished out in stride. He couldn't have wiped the silly grin off his face, even if he had tried. Both Madisons hugged Mac and his children goodnight, with Sarah giving him an especially tender squeeze before she left. Then, hand in hand with Amber and Emmy, they headed off into the darkness toward the Doucette site. Mac watched them until he could no longer hear their night whispers, and the swaying of their flashlight disappeared from sight. He smiled to himself, and turned to herd his own brood in the direction of their sleeping bags. Prayers were said all around, followed by goodnight kisses and giggles from Kate in low conversation with her older brother, who would occasionally burst out in a harsh whisper so everyone could hear,
"Cut it out, Kate. Oh, I mean it. You are such a brat.
And eventually, silence. Mac packed up what he could by the light of the lanterns and soon decided to leave the rest till daylight. They weren't planning to leave until early afternoon anyway. He brewed his final nightly cup of coffee and sat sipping it in front of the fire that had burned itself down to a flickering mass of red-hot coals. It was so easy to get lost inside such a bed of glowing, undulating embers. He was alone. Yet, not alone. Wasn't that a line from the Bruce Coburn song, Rumors of Glory? He wasn't sure, but if he remembered, he would look it up when he got home. As he sat mesmerized by the fire and wrapped in its warmth, he prayed, mostly prayers of thanksgiving. He had been given so much. Blessed was probably the right word. He was content, at rest, and full of peace. Mac did not know it then, but within 24 hours his prayers would change drastically. The next morning, though sunny and warm, didn't start off so well. Mac rose early to surprise the kids with a wonderful breakfast, but burned two fingers while trying to free flapjacks that had stuck to the griddle. In response to the searing pain, he knocked over the stove and griddle and dropped the bowl of pancake batter onto the sandy ground. The kids, startled awake by the clatter and under-the-breath expletives, had stuck their heads out of the tent trailer to see what all the commotion was about. They began to giggle as soon as they grasped the situation. But one, "Hey, it's not funny," from Mac, and they ducked back into the safety of the tent, still tittering from their hideout while they watched through the mesh windows. So breakfast, instead of the feast Mac had intended, was cold cereal with half and half, since the last of the milk had gone into the pancake batter. Mac spent the next hour trying to organize the sight with two fingers stuck in a glass of ice water, which had to be refreshed frequently with chips that Josh broke off the ice block with the backside of a spoon. Word must have gotten out, because Sarah Madison showed up with burn first aid, and within minutes of having his fingers slathered in the whitish liquid, he felt the sting recede. About that time, Josh and Kate, having completed their ordered chores, showed up to ask if they could go out in the Doucette's canoe one last time, promising to wear life jackets. After the initial mandatory no and the required amount of begging from the kids, especially Kate, Mac finally gave in, reminding them once again of the rules of canoe safety and conduct. He wasn't too concerned. Their campsite was only a stone's throw from the lake, and they promised to stay close in to shore. Mac would be able to keep an eye on them while he continued packing up the camp. Missy was busy at the table, coloring in the book from Multnomah Falls. "She's just too cute," Mac thought, glancing in her direction as he worked to clean up the mess he had made earlier. She was dressed in the only clean thing she had left, a little red sundress with embroidered wildflowers, a Joseph purchase from their first day's trip into town. About 15 minutes later, Mac looked up when he heard a familiar voice calling, "Daddy!" from the direction of the lake. It was Kate, and she and her brother were paddling like pros out on the water. Both were obediently wearing their life jackets, and he waved at them. It is remarkable how a seemingly insignificant action or event can change entire lives. Kate, lifting her paddle to wave back in response, lost her balance and tipped the canoe. There was a frozen look of terror on her face as almost in silence and slow motion it rolled over. Josh frantically leaned to try and balance, but it was too late, and he disappeared from sight in the midst of the splash. Mac was already headed for the water's edge, not intending to go in, but to be near when they bobbed up. Kate was up first, sputtering and crying, but there was no sign of Josh. Then, suddenly, an eruption of water and legs, and Mac knew instantly that something was terribly wrong. To his amazement, all the instincts he had honed as a teenage lifeguard came roaring back. In a matter of seconds, he hit the water, shoes and shirt off. He didn't even notice the icy shock as he began racing the 50 feet out toward the overturned canoe, ignoring for the moment the terrified sobbing of his daughter. She was safe. His primary focus was Josh. Taking a deep breath, he dove under. The water, in spite of all the churning, was still fairly clear, with visibility about 3 feet. He found Josh quickly, and also discovered why he was in trouble. One of the straps on his life vest had gotten tangled in the canoe webbing. Try as he might, he couldn't yank it free either, so he tried to signal Josh to push himself deeper inside the canoe, where breathable air was trapped. But the poor boy was panicking, straining against the strap that was keeping him caught under the canoe rim and underwater. Mac surfaced, yelled at Kate to swim to shore, gulped whatever he could, and went under a second time. By his third dive, and knowing time was running out, Mac realized that he could either keep trying to free Josh from the vest or flip the canoe. Since Josh, in his panic, was not letting anyone near him, Mac chose the latter. Whether it was God and angels or God and adrenaline, he would never know for sure. But on only his second attempt, he succeeded in rolling the canoe over, freeing Josh from his tether. The jacket, finally able to do what it was designed for, now kept the boy's face above water. Mac surfaced behind Josh, who now was limp and unconscious, blood oozing from a gash on his head where the canoe had banged him as Mac had righted it. He immediately began mouth-to-mouth on his son as best he could, while others, who had heard the commotion, arrived to pull him and the canoe with the attached vest toward the shallows. Oblivious to the shouts around him, as people barked instructions and questions, Mac focused on his task, his own panic building inside his chest. Just as his feet touched solid ground, Josh began to cough and throw up water and breakfast. A huge cheer erupted from everyone gathered, but Mac couldn't care less. Overwhelmed with relief and the adrenaline rush of a narrow escape, he began to cry. And then suddenly, Kate was sobbing with her arms around his neck, and everyone was laughing and crying and hugging. Somehow, they all made it to shore. Among those who had been drawn to the scene by the panic and noise were Jesse Madison and Emil Doucette. Through the mayhem of cheers and relief, Mac could hear Emil's voice, like the repetitious chant of a rosary, whispering again and again, "I am so sorry. I am so sorry. I am so sorry." It was his canoe. It could have been his children. Mac found him, wrapped his arms around the younger man, and emphasized strongly in his ear, "Stop it. This wasn't your fault, and everyone's okay." Emil began to sob, emotion suddenly freed from behind a dam of pent-up guilt and fear. A potential crisis had been averted, or so Mac thought. To continue, please insert the next CD.